The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi. The first thing I want to say is that I'm sorry that I'm late. Did you know that I was late? Thank you for not noticing that I was late. The Google Map said that it would take 16 minutes to get here from the airport, which was a small misunderstanding between Google and Philadelphia, because it actually took an hour and 26 minutes. Which is why I'm not wearing a button-down shirt. I apologize for that. My shirt says that it says sushi and country music and Nintendo, which are three things that I like. When I first wrote down on my website that there were three things that I liked, the words sushi and country music and Nintendo had never been written in that order in the whole history of the internet. Thanks. I feel very powerful now. I don't even need this thing, really, because I'm always yelling. But before I start talking about my book and my writing, during the hour and 26 minutes that I just spent entering your lovely city on 76 West, a highway that I wish to forget that it exists, while that was happening, I was thinking about how transformative books can be in one's life, and stories can be in one's life, and writing can be in one's life. And I want to give you an actual real-life example of this that occurred to me while I was not going on a spree killing during the traffic. There's a writer named David Foster Wallace, who's one of my favorite writers. When I was 17, I read a book that he wrote. It had just come out, and it kind of changed my life, and it had all of these footnotes. And my second novel, An Abundance of Catherines, also has footnotes and kind of an homage to him. And he's just this wonderful writer. And I went to a small college in Ohio called Kenyon. And after I graduated there, David Foster Wallace gave a commencement speech. And the commencement speech, if you ever have an interest in commencement speeches, are you guys like reasonably close to graduating from high school? Okay, so when you graduate from high school, there will be a commencement speech. And the one thing that I can tell you in advance about that speech is that it will suck. It's a great and storied tradition in American history that you are made to sit through a 20-minute speech given by someone who is of some level of prestige, and that the speech sucks. It's like no matter how talented the person giving the speech is, everything good about their ability to talk or to write down ideas leaves their body moments before they begin to write these terrible commencement speeches. Which makes it all the more miraculous that David Foster Wallace's commencement speech at Kenyon in 2005 was so amazingly good. And the way he starts out the speech is by saying telling a story, which is the same way that your crappy commencement speaker will begin his or her commencement speech, because it's one of the sort of time-honored tropes of the genre. But I want to tell you the story, and I want to tell you why it kept me from losing my mind during the hour and 26-minute, 7-mile drive from the airport to here. So there are these two young fish, swimming, and they're swimming together, and they swim past an older fish. And the old man fish says, "Good morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two fish don't say anything. They just kind of swim along. And then after a bit, one of them turns to the other and says, "What the hell is water?" Because you wouldn't know, right? It's the only thing that you've been involved in. It's the only thing that you've been doing the whole time that you've had a consciousness of doing something. The great challenge that we face as adults that you guys don't have to face quite so much yet is that we have these sort of treacherously boring and repetitive lives of day in and day out, having to go to the grocery store, having to pay our taxes, having to wash our laundry, having to shave each morning, which I just find absolutely repulsive, having to like do these things again and again and again. And you're just beginning to do those things, and so there may be a kind of joy to that routine. But for me, having done them every single day for 20 years, it's just unbearable. And we have this responsibility as humans to remind ourselves that no matter what is happening, whether it's something wonderful, like I'm finding out that my book is going to be made into a movie, or it's something like driving for an hour and 27 minutes to get 7 miles through Philadelphia when you desperately want to be here on time to visit with these nice people, this is water. This is also water. Like everything around us, this is water. We have to remind ourselves that like this is also life. There's I think a kind of sacredness or sacrality to all of those experiences, which is how I manage not to go on a spree killing. One thing that I don't have is my book. Would someone loan it to me? Because I notice there are a number of copies of them in the audience. Thank you. Okay. Oh, it looks like you're right at the end, but you haven't finished. You have like 5 pages left. Wow. I mean, I don't know what to think about the fact that you were able to just like turn it off at page 299. You know? You're really like, this has been fun, but I think I'm going to stop here. So like the reason that those two fish say what the hell is water, I think, broadly, is that one of the weird things about being a person is that we spend our entire lives stuck inside of our heads, right? Like I can only see out of my eyes, I can only have my consciousness, I can only be like a white guy who used to be skinny, who's now about 5 pounds overweight. Like I can only be that, you know, like that's the only person I can be, the only consciousness I can have. And I can never know exactly what it's like to be you. I can't know what it's like to have your family. I can't know what it's like to have your job. I can't know what it's like to have the unique brain that you have. And so it's really easy for me to sort of imagine myself endlessly complexly. Like, I am both cool and nerd. I am both good-looking and ugly. I am both, like, funny and really not funny. You know, I can see myself as occupying all of these things. Whereas, like, with you, no offense, it's really easy for me to dismiss you because you just aren't as interesting as I am on some level, right? Like, as interesting as other... Let me give you an example. When some girl breaks up with you, or some guy breaks up with you, it is the central event in human history, right? Like, it is important enough that it should be on the cover of Us Weekly, certainly. And when your best friend, when someone breaks up with them, it's like, it's important and it matters to you, but also... you kind of wish that they would shut up about it after a while. This is part of the phenomenon of us being hardwired to believe that what happens to us and what we see and what we feel is just inherently more real and more complex and more interesting than what happens to other people. And I think, I don't want to diss this phenomenon because first off, I think it's human. Second off, if we all felt the pain of the world as intensely as we feel our own pain, we would like blow up, right? Because 155,000 people are going to die today. And I hope that none of them is in this room, and I hope that we don't know any of them. But if we felt the loss of those 155,000 people every single day the way we would feel the loss of someone we love, you know, we wouldn't be here, like you wouldn't go to school, and I wouldn't travel to Philadelphia because we would all just be sitting in our rooms bawling. So I think we have to balance the fact that, like, we can't feel the pain of others in quite the same way that we can feel our own pain. We have to balance that with the fact that we really have a requirement to imagine one another complexly. That's what Paper Towns is about. It's about a young woman portrayed here on the cover named Margot Roth Spiegelman, who the people in her life don't imagine complexly. In the corner with the chatting. Okay. And it goes on. Then they have to, like, chat about the fact that they've been called out. I know what it's like because I was there. This girl, the girl in this book, Margot Roth Spiegelman, her friends don't imagine her complexly at all. They either see her as this sort of, so her next door neighbor Q, the guy who's who narrates the novel, sees her as this sort of manic pixie dream girl, which is a phrase invented by my friend Nathan Raven, who works at The Onion, and I think it's a great phrase. Like, when we imagine girls, we imagine, like, girls we love, we always imagine them as being, like, more than human, as being, like, you know, having, like, access to awesome that the rest of us don't have access to, you know, that, like, she can, like, do things and be things and embody things that the rest of us just can't do or be or embody. And I think that is treacherous. There's a girl phenomenon like this, too, what one might call the Edward Cullenization of the romantic other, because when you think about boys, there's this guy named Edward Cullen who's a vampire. Wait, hold on. Can I tell you a quick side story? I recently did one of these things. This has absolutely nothing to do with anything except that I just thought about it. I recently did this exact sort of thing in San Francisco, California, and I talked for like 30 minutes, and I thought it went pretty great. Everybody was like laughing and giggling the whole time, and I thought it was going pretty well. And then I said, do you guys have any questions? And like 60 people raised their hands, which is like 58 more than had ever raised their hands in my entire career. And I was like, wow, you are gifted, John Green. And so I called on someone, and they said, Mr. Green, are you aware of the fact that your fly is down? And I was like... And then I said, are there any other questions? None. So that's why I turned around, because I had a moment of like flashback panic, like post-traumatic stress disorder, where I thought like it could have happened again, you know, because I came here, I was kind of in a hurry, I just like ran straight from the car and like I don't know, and then I peed right before I came out. It's totally possible. So yeah. That really didn't have anything to do with anything. But I will say this about the Edward Cullenization of the romantic other. Like, it doesn't matter if it's a boy imagining a girl as more than a person or a girl imagining a boy as more than a person. This dude, Edward Cullen, is this 107-year-old vampire, but even though he's 107 years old, it's like somehow socially acceptable for him to date 17-year-old girls. He doesn't fart. Not a joke. He really doesn't. He doesn't have any kind of bodily functions. I mean, he is this romanticized male, like, to a degree that the rest of it, like, I mean, to a hilarious degree, but for some reason doesn't seem to bother you guys. But he's like hot, but he's dangerous. But he's gentlemanly, you know, obviously. And he sparkles in the sunshine. There are no fictional constructions in my description of this dude. So, like, whether you're imagining a boy who sparkles in the sunshine and never has to pee, or you're imagining a girl who is sort of, like, larger than life and beautiful and, like, the answer to all of your problems, you're doing both them and you a disservice. Because other human beings are human beings, and they are human beings in precisely the same way that you are. They are as complex as you are. They are as fascinating as you are. If you guys have read any of this book, you might have noticed that I'm obsessed with the poet Walt Whitman. And in Song of Myself, Walt Whitman writes, "I contain multitudes," and that's so true of all of us. We all contain multitudes. We all contain more than one identity, and so we always do someone a disservice when we say that they are just awesome, or we say that they are just nerdy, or we say that they are just a girl or just a boy or just gay or just straight or whatever it is, because we all contain multitudes and we have to do a better job of acknowledging that. So Paper Towns really at its core is about that, but it's also about the way that we sort of fail to imagine our stories complexly. Like, it's not only people that we have trouble imagining, we also have a lot of trouble imagining our stories. Are there any, like, little tiny kids in the audience? Really, I'm not just asking that. Is there anyone, like, under 10? Raise your hand if you're under 10. There's no one under 10. Okay, so I'm going to read a part of this story, and since there's no one under 10, we're confirmed on that. Because I did this recently, and I broke some news to a kid, and I feel pretty bad about it. All right, so I think all you need to know for the part that I'm going to read is that the book is narrated by this guy, Q, who has been in love with Margot Roth-Spiegelman, the woman portrayed on the cover, his entire life. And Q's two best friends are Ben, this guy who believes that, like, the best way to get a girl is to call her a honey bunny, and Radar, this semi-professional editor of a website that's identical to Wikipedia called Omnictionary. Radar's African-American. That's important. Okay. And Radar has a date to prom, which is surprising because he's a semi-professional editor of Wikipedia. So I'm going to read the part where Q and Ben are meeting Radar's prom date for the first time. She wants to come over to his house. I'm going to read from page 19, but I'm going to skip around a little bit. But yeah, we're going to start on page 19, and then we're going to talk about the Black Santas. I was thinking about how Radar's parents actually were in the Guinness Book of World Records when I noticed a pretty African-American girl with spiky little dreads standing above us. It took me a moment to realize that the girl was Angela, Radar's, I guess, girlfriend. "Hi," she said to me. "Hey," I said. I'd had classes with Angela, and I knew her a little, but we didn't say hello in the hallway or anything. I motioned for her to sit. She scooted a chair to the head of the table. "I figure you guys probably know Marcus better than anyone," she said, using Radar's real name. She leaned toward us, her elbows on the table. "Oh, I'm not going to work blue, by the way. It's a crap job, see? But someone's got to do it," Ben answered, smiling. "Do you think he's, like, embarrassed of me?" Ben laughed. "What? No," he said. "Technically," I added, "you should be embarrassed of him." She rolled her eyes, smiling, a girl accustomed to compliments. "But he's never, like, invited me to hang out with you, though." "Oh," I said, "that's because he's embarrassed of us." I'm going to skip ahead. "But really, you wouldn't worry? I mean, we've been dating for 5 weeks, and he's never even taken me to his house." Ben and I exchanged a knowing glance, and I scrunched up my face to suppress laughter. "What?" she asked. "Nothing," I said. "Honestly, Angela, if he were forcing you to hang out with us and taking you to his house all the time, then it would definitely mean he did not like you." Are his parents weird? I struggled with how to answer that question honestly. No, they're cool. They're just kind of overprotective, I guess. Yeah, overprotective, Ben agreed a little too quickly. She smiled and then got up, saying she had to go say hi to someone before lunch was over. Ben waited until she was gone to say anything. "That girl's awesome," Ben said. "I know," I answered. "I wonder if we can replace Radar with her. She's probably not that good with computers, though. We need someone who's good at computers. Plus, I bet she sucks at Resurrection, which was our favorite video game. By the way," Ben added, "nice call saying Radar's folks are overprotective." "Well, it's not my place to tell her," I said. I'm going to skip ahead again. "Speaking of reasons you wish you had fourth period lunch," I said, "we just dined with Angela." They're talking to Radar now. Ben smirked at Radar and said, "Yeah, she wants to know why she's never been over to your house." Radar exhaled a long breath as he spun the combination to open his locker. He breathed for so long I thought he might pass out. "Crap," he said finally. "Are you embarrassed about something?" I asked. "Shut up," he answered, poking his elbow into my gut. "You live in a lovely home," I said. "Seriously, bro," added Ben, "she's a nice girl. I don't see why you can't introduce her to your parents and show her Casa Radar." Radar threw his books into his locker and shut it. The din of conversation around us quieted just a bit as he turned his eyes toward the heavens and shouted, "It is not my fault that my parents own the world's largest collection of Black Santas." I'd heard Radar say the world's largest collection of Black Santas probably 1,000 times in my life, and it never became any less funny to me. But he wasn't kidding. I remembered the first time I visited. I was maybe 13. It was spring, many months past Christmas, and yet black Santas lined the windowsills. Paper cutouts of black Santas hung from the stairway banister. Black Santa candles adorned the dining room table. A black Santa oil painting hung above the mantle, which was itself lined with black Santa figurines. The light-up plastic black Santa that stood in their front yard from Thanksgiving to New Year's spent the rest of the year proudly keeping watch in the corner of a guest bathroom, a bathroom with homemade black Santa wallpaper made with paint and a Santa-shaped sponge. As a plaque beside their front door proclaimed, Radar's house was an officially registered Santa landmark, according to the Society for Christmas. You just gotta tell her, man, I said. You just gotta say, Angela, I really like you, but there's something you need to know. When we go to my house to hook up, we will be watched by the 2,400 eyes of 1,200 black Santas. Radar ran a hand through his buzz cut and shook his head. Yeah, I don't think I'll put it exactly like that, but I'll deal with it. So that's what I'm gonna read from Paper Towns, I think. Thanks. I gotta make sure my phone's off. Okay. So here's my question for you guys, and it's like a sincere, non-ironic question. Why is Santa white? You have to raise your hands because I can't hear the chorus. Yes. Because he started in Europe. Sort of, but not really, though, because, I mean, like, Santa is based on this idea of Saint Nick, Saint Nicholas, who was sort of European, but not like what we would now probably, he was not necessarily what we would now consider white. Santa Claus as like the phenomenon that we know him today with like the red outfit and the beard and kind of fat, like Saint Nicholas was emaciatedly skinny, like all saints from the 15th century or whenever. But like this like fat guy who comes down through the chimney is a uniquely American creation. America has never been like a white country. I mean, I guess it was probably majority white in 1910 when Santa was created. Other possible reasons include, someone said, recently I asked that question, and someone said because he lives at the North Pole. Not a bad point, but I would argue that, like, what is it about, do the other people who live at the North Pole, are they also white? Like, it's true. I like that angle. I would argue that more than like Santa Claus's association with also white polar bears, I would argue that Santa's whiteness was constructed because Santa was made up. Sorry if that's news. That's the news that I broke to some 6-year-old a couple weeks ago. He was gonna find out. You know, I just sort of sped up the process, but he was like ushered out of the room. It was horrible. It was devastating. It's the first time that you realize that like your parents are like horrible liars. But anyway, so we made Santa up to sell crap to white people. That's the only reason. And white people had the majority of purchasing power in America when we made up Santa. That's why Santa's white. And why is Santa white now? It's because he's always been white. There is no reason why Santa can't be African-American. And what Radar's parents are arguing for with their collection of black Santas, ultimately, is for a more complex understanding of Santa, for seeing Santa as a figure in our mythology available to all people and as trying to reimagine our myths more complexly. Angela, Radar's girlfriend, points this out to Radar later in the book, and then he responds, I always think about how I'm imagining my myths when I eat my frickin' Lucky Charms with my frickin' black Santa spoon. But I think on this one, Radar's wrong and his parents are right. And that's hopefully, at least, Paper Towns is about not only the responsibility that we have as human beings to one another, to imagine one another more complexly, and to imagine one another empathetically, for me to be able to look at you and to do a better job of imagining what it's like to be you, instead of only imagining what your role is in my life, trying to also imagine what my role might be in your life. I think that we also have that same responsibility to stories and to whether, you know, whether those are sort of mythological stories or the stories that that we read when we read novels. Like, I think we have a responsibility to not only like read the words in the story, but to try to read well, to try to read in a way that allows us, when we are driving down the highway at 1.6 miles per hour for an hour and 20 minutes, that allows us to say, this is also water. This is water. Because that, to me, I really adhere to this belief that fiction and books can be transformative, and they can give us tools to live better, richer lives, and to live better with one another. I don't believe that we read stories only for the purposes of being entertained. That's why your teachers are torturing you in your English classes, trying to get you to read critically and comparatively, is because reading ultimately isn't just about knowing the skill of reading. It isn't ultimately just about literacy. It's also about how to be a person and how to be a better person in a world that is sort of annoyingly full of other people who are clogging our lives, who are keeping us from getting here on time, who are keeping us from getting to the front of the line at the grocery store. Like all of these other people who we can see as impediments, but if we begin to imagine what it's like to be them, that to them we are impediments, if we can begin to see that, that's when we can say, this is water, this is water, this is water. And there's a kind of peace in that, I think. So that's the thing that I wanted to say before I took your many fascinating questions, which I'm so excited about, which I'm going to do for 17 minutes. Oh, we're going to put mics in the aisles. That's exciting. Wow. So that way everyone gets to hear your question, and then you will feel terrified and not want to stand in and ask your question, but you will, because you'll get extra credit for it. Thank you. God, I love teachers. Topics that we can discuss include, like, my books, other people's books, and then, like, that's about, and then I saw, I guess, maybe the writing, or, like, yeah, that's also acceptable. Yes, I'll just repeat your question, since you're in the middle of an aisle. Did I base the people in this book off anybody in my life? Yeah, in some ways, but not that directly. So no one would ever say, like, I'm Margot, or I'm Radar, or I'm Ben. But I think all writers will steal from anyone. You steal from whatever you see or you hear, like whatever's funny or interesting. As an example, if you've read the book, you know that a lot of the book takes place in an abandoned mini mall in Orlando, Florida, this place that has been abandoned for about 30 years. I broke into a lot of... I don't recommend doing this, but when I was researching the novel, I broke into a lot of buildings that have been abandoned for decades, and there's this hobby called urban exploring, where people do this, and since it was such an important part of the book, I wanted to understand it. So I stole a lot from the people I met when I was urban exploring, from the way that they felt about abandoned buildings, and I put a lot of that into Margot, for instance. But none of those people were like beautiful 17-year-old girls, you know? Huh? Who am I? I mean, I'm probably most like Ben, unfortunately. My high school self, at least, was probably most like Ben. I identify a little bit with all the characters. I think I have to, but my high school self was unfortunately probably most like Ben. Yes? Run up. Yes.
Hi, I'm Zynga, and my curiosity lies within the title. What is the symbolism of paper towels?
Well, that's a good question. Thanks. Did you all hear it? Okay. So, Paper Towns has three meanings. The book is divided into three sections. The first part is called the strings, the second part is called the grass, and the third part is called the vessel. And in each of those three parts of Paper Towns, the characters in the novel have a different understanding of what Paper Towns means. And I'll tell you all three of them because I find them interesting real quickly. The first is they think it means like a sort of fake place. Like, y'all live in a real cool American city, but most people don't. And I didn't when I was growing up. I lived in Orlando, Florida, which is arguably the worst place in the world to live. Arguably the worst place in America to live. But So they think it's such this like plastic place because it was designed all at once and all built badly, and so it's all cul-de-sacs and all quarter-acre lots with front yards, and it's just sort of hideous and very monochromatic. That's the first meaning of paper towns, like a house, a place that's so flimsy it's built out of paper. And the second part, they think that the meaning is these. There's a weird phenomenon in Florida where people will start to build a subdivision. I was just in the Netherlands, and I was trying to explain to them what a subdivision was, and it's impossible. Like, I was also trying to explain to them what a cul-de-sac was. You know what a cul-de-sac is? Like, where it ends in a circle. And they were like, is it like a roundabout? And I was like, no, because the roundabout keeps going. It just ends. And they were like, well, why doesn't it go somewhere? And I was like, why indeed? So that's the second. So in Orlando and around Orlando, people will sometimes start to build subdivisions, then they will run out of money. And so they will pave the streets, they will build mailboxes and street signs, but there will never be any houses. And in fact, one of the most famous ones of these in Orlando is used as a runway for drug runners. They fly the drugs in from South America, and they land on these abandoned streets where they never built any houses, and then they offload the stuff, and then they fly back using the street as a runway again. I won't talk about the third meaning unless maybe there's time, because it's kind of a spoiler. Yes?
What encouraged you or inspired you to write books?
What encourages me or
inspires you to write books?
When I first started?
Yes.
What encouraged me or inspired me when I first started? That's a good question. Well, a lot of it, to be honest, was that I wanted, you know, I was talking earlier about how, like, on some level, like, I'm the only person that I get to be. And a lot of it, some of it was wanting to be able to imagine what it was like to be someone else, like wanting to write about people who aren't me, you know, to not have to be stuck inside of my consciousness so much for a while. And then some of it was also, like, I wanted other people to, like, hear my story, you know, like I wanted other people. We all have this ceaseless desire to have other people acknowledge us as real people and to care about us and to take our joy seriously and our pain seriously and to acknowledge the reality of our feelings. And I think maybe the best way I ever found to get people to do that with me was writing. Like I was better at telling that kind of story than I was at trying to tell someone a story and make them care about it. So I really started, to be totally honest with you, my first novel was called Looking for Alaska, and I started it after I had this horrendous breakup. This girl had dumped me, and when I fit, it's okay, it worked out fine. But when I started Looking for Alaska, I remember like when my best friend read Looking for Alaska, which is not a book in any literal way about any particular girl. She finished it and she came downstairs to where I was working on my second book in the basement, and she said, "That's the best book I've ever read about Emily Chambers," which it sort of on some level was. So I think like some of it for me was wanting other people to hear. Wanting other people to care about the things that had happened to me that hurt me. The other thing was that I worked for 6 months as a chaplain at a children's hospital right after I graduated from college, like as a sort of minister in training at a children's hospital. And I saw so much grief and death and horrible things happen that I really felt, in the wake of that, I kind of couldn't get over it, you know? And so it was a way of trying to like process that trauma that I had witnessed. So,
I'm Erin. I'm a nerd fighter.
Nice. If you don't know what a nerd fighter is, I'll tell you briefly. A nerd fighter is someone who watches the video blogs that I make with my brother. I am, in fact, much more famous for making video blogs than I am for writing books. Yeah. Thanks. You should watch all 465. It will only take you 25 hours. But yeah, so and nerd fighters are people who fight for nerd rights and nerd culture and like embrace intellectualism and believe that being thoughtful is better than being vapid. Okay.
There's a lot of research. It seems like a lot of research goes into your books, like with Abundance of Catherines. There's like algorithms and everything.
Yeah.
And with Paper Towns, it seems like a lot of research. Did you like put hours and hours into it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I wish it had only been hours and hours. Yeah, I spent a lot of time researching. My second book is about a child prodigy, and I don't know anything about being a child prodigy, and Abundance of Catherines is about a child prodigy, and so I had to read what it was like to be a child prodigy. For Paper Towns, it was a lot of reading and rereading Walt Whitman and reading about, like, what people had written about Walt Whitman and, like, biographies of him. But then also, I hadn't lived in Orlando since I was 14 years old, so I had to sort of relearn the city of Orlando. So that was a lot of work. And then breaking into abandoned buildings, which, as research goes, isn't that bad. Yes?
Okay, so the list in the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
You wrote it so well. Do you have any experience with that type of thing?
No. Yeah, no.
Are you sure? Because the fish got really deep when you said the chair and all that. I just wanted to know. Where did that come from?
I'll tell you something. An interesting side note is that as part of having this video blog with my brother wrote a song about the list, and it's nothing... Like, the words are all taken from the book, and it's hilarious. And if you Google my name and the words, the list, you can hear the song. No, I never did anything like that, I promise. The fish thing was taken from someone I know. So if that seemed real, it's because someone had done that. But I didn't have the kind of moral courage to pwn people in that way when I was in high school. Yeah. It's kind of loud. You're okay.
I just wanted to ask, because I was sitting there, and you just said... nerd rights.
Yeah.
Can you explain?
Explain nerd rights.
Yeah.
Yeah, like that's a good question. So like one of the ways when we do a poor job, when we don't do a good job of imagining other people, one of the ways that we tend to dismiss other people or to see them as like less than fully human is to think of them as being nerds. So that that becomes easy to dismiss people who might socialize differently from most people, or might have trouble making friends, or even might just happen to prefer reading books to like giving a crap about the love life of Lindsay Lohan. Whatever it is, like I think that there's kind of like a something really profoundly awesome about that. And my brother and I don't think it's going to be breaking news if I tell you that I was a nerd when I was growing up. But I wasn't, that's not the same thing as being a good student, I have to say, because I wasn't a very good student, but I was pretty nerdy. As I got older, I wanted to be someone who could kind of like stand up for nerds and say that I think that nerdiness is awesome, which I do. So that's what nerd fighters are really about. Yeah.
I wanted to know if you ever had a Margot in your life, and if so, tell us.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely done a poor job of imagining girls. You know, I've definitely sort of seen girls as being more awesome than they actually are, and that sort of always ends the relationship. Like, because you can't have a relationship between, like, one person and one idea, you know? You can only have a relationship between two people. And so when one person is thinking of the other as a person and the other person is thinking of the other as just, like, the embodiment of awesome, that's not going to work long term, you know? Because at some point either the embodiment of awesome is going to disappoint you and prove to be human, or the embodiment of awesome is going to get tired of you not treating them like a person and is going to dump you. So yeah, I had a number of times when I experienced that before I figured that out. Figured it out like 6 weeks ago. No. Yeah. Yes.
Hi, my name is Deshauna from South Philadelphia High School. My question to you is, I noticed that some of the books that you wrote attracts young readers.
Yeah.
Particularly teens. When reading Paper Towns, I want to know, what do you expect for the teens to gain out of your book and why?
It's a good question. What do I expect teens to gain out of my book and why? I mean, I really like writing for teenagers, and I feel strongly about writing for high school students because the books I read when I was in high school are still with me, you know, a few years later. And also, I'm not old. I resent the implication of your laughs. It's not funny. That's a big part of it for me, is that those books are still with me. And, you know, as far as what you get out of it, like, that's as much your job, your choice as my choice, you know? Because the book, what I love about books is that the book isn't finished until you read it, right? Like, the book doesn't really exist until you read it. This is just scratches on a page. Like, it doesn't have any inherent meaning. Like, the difference between books and movies... I lost your place, but you're on page 299. The difference between books and movies is that the movies are already there for you. Like the images are there, the music is there, the dialogue is there. All you have to do is listen to it. This you have to make. Like, I provide a kind of blueprint for you, and then you make the story. And so if you make the story about a girl who's really awesome and she goes away and it's not clear what happened to her and it's kind of an intense mystery and then it ends, that's cool with me. And if you make the story about failing to imagine other people as complexly as we ought to, that's great to me too. But like, I think of it as a collaboration between you and me, and so I can't tell you what to get out of it, you know, because you've got to build the building. All I did was make the blueprint. Does that make sense?
Right. So do you believe that some of the things that you touched on in your book actually relates to teens today? Like,
I do, yeah. Well, I mean, I think, like, the big thing that relates to... I think that, like, the experience is pretty universal of teenagers, of teenagehood. I think that experience is pretty... doesn't change that much over time. I might be wrong, but, like, I still like Catcher in the Rye. I still think it's interesting. I still think A Separate Piece is interesting. What? Oh, you're about to read Catcher in the Rye? Oh, it's so good. Oh, you're in for a treat. Can we just... Every time, the only thing that I request, too much noise. Shh. The only thing that I request is that when you read Catch in the Rye, you pay close attention to every time that he touches or talks about or puts on his red hunting cap, which I think is the most like heartbreaking symbol in the history of literature. Yes?
I was wondering, while writing the book, was there anything that stopped you like from writing it? To finish?
Yeah, like writer's block kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, well, it took 2 years to write, and it only has 80,000 words in it. So, yeah, there were a number of stops along the way. I mean, for me, a big part of the process is revision. I probably wrote 800,000 words in the course of writing this 80,000-word novel, so I deleted 90% of the stuff that I wrote along the way. I think ultimately, like, that's what being a good writer is being able to rewrite, not being able to, like, write down something awesome the first time. That's the first thing that I would say. The second thing that I would say is that I just kind of give myself permission to do the best I can and to understand that I'm not, you know, J.D. Salinger or Toni Morrison. Like, it's not going to come out perfect every time. So when you give yourself that permission, I think it becomes a lot easier to get writing done. I think this might be our last question. Yeah. Okay. No pressure.
Jeez, okay. Well, actually, we're from Nazareth Academy. Maureen Johnson went to our school.
What's that, huh?
Maureen Johnson went to our school.
Maureen Johnson went to your school?
I just run that by you.
Maureen Johnson is like my best friend. She's also a writer of books, and she's my best friend.
Yeah. So she actually visited our school last year.
Okay.
Yeah. My question is, when you're writing, it's kind of random, but like I know me and my friends, we all like to write. So how do you get ideas for names?
How do I get ideas for names? Yeah. That's not that random of a question, actually, and thank you for it. It's a good last note. The main girl in this book is called Margot Roth Spiegelman. If you've read the book, you know that there's a lot of like black Santas. There's also a lot of white in the novel. There's a gigantic white cow who almost ends everything, who's clearly like Moby Dick, except he's land-based. He's actually referred to as a great white wall of cow, and like in Moby Dick, the whale is referred to as a great white wall repeatedly. Generally in the book, like white is pretty bad and black is pretty good. Like Santa's pretty awesome and cows that try to kill you are pretty bad. Roth is a German word that means red, that's intended to sort of separate Margot from this kind of monochromatic world that the other kids in the book have created. And Spiegelman means mirror maker, like the dude in the old German villages who was the mirror maker, the guy who made the mirrors was the Spiegelman. And that's really important to me because Margot is the mirror maker in the novel. Like when the characters in the novel look at her, they don't see Margot. And that's their whole problem. The whole problem of finding out what happened to Margot is that they don't see Margot when they look at her. They see some reflection of themselves. And so what they see ends up saying more about them than it says about Margot. And so when I'm trying to think of character names, I try to think of those little resonances that will tell us something about the character without being too obvious, you know, that just kind of like add something... a little something to the character. I mean, Holden Caulfield, who talks about wanting to be, wanting to like hold kids in these fields. I mean, you know, it's relatively subtle, but it's there. You know, that he wants to, like, take care of people. He wants to, like, you know, be the catcher in the rye field. Yeah, so that's where I come up with character names, or I try to start with those resonances and then also just have names that don't sound ridiculous. You guys have been fantastic. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. You're awesome.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to prepare for the book signing. Okay, so this is the last, well, it's not the last time. It's the next to last time I'm going to say it. So everybody should actually already have this ready, but we are going to open our books and we are going to turn to the title page. It says Paper Towns, John Green, Dutton Books. And you should all have your sticky notes, golf pencils. Your name should be written nice and large. And the first group, we're going to call you up by group, so please stay seated. And our first group is going to be Little Flower. And we should just give him one more round of applause for being, like, awesomely nerdy.
You're awesome. Oh, I like you.
Our next group is going to be Girl Space. And you should come down. There we go. Perfect. Followed by PET. So just go across. Across. Yep. Go that way. There you go.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.